Our first case today is DeChambeau v. Balkenbush. It's case number 72879. When you approach the bench, please state your name for the record and any co-counsel or any parties that might be present. Are we ready to begin?
We are.
All right. So we'll hear from the appellant. Would you like any rebuttal time? So 5 minutes, you don't want any of that? Maybe 3 minutes?
Yeah, a couple minutes.
I'll give you three. Thank you.
I'm Charles Kozak. I represent the DeChambeau family. Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you for hearing our plea here. I don't know really how much we can add to our briefs. Our basic argument is that there was a remand on an appeal that was granted to us. It doesn't seem to us that the defendant should have an opportunity to go back and reopen discovery and name a new expert, one who basically had a different theory of the case. What that is, was not really clear in the trial testimony. And whether the court exceeded its discretion in issuing a scheduling order when the Supreme Court remanded the case for further proceedings consistent with that order.
So I have a question on exactly that. I see that you end up having a scheduling conference upon remand, and that was on January 21st of 2016. So now all the parties are there, and I get that you're not going to report this. It's why report it. So nothing's reported. In your moving papers, it looks like you claim that you objected to this. Then the court comes down with a written scheduling order on February 1st of 2016. So now you have a written order. Why did you wait until after they designate, right at the close of the new scheduling order, to object to it and then do a writ? Why didn't you, once that scheduling order was done, and it's a written scheduling order in February, why didn't you do a motion, say in 10 days for a reconsideration, to say, look, there's nothing to do here. The Supreme Court reversed. We're ready for trial. I object. Why didn't you do that after that scheduling order?
I guess because we really weren't sure that the scheduling order was going to make any difference. It covers a lot of different issues, but we were not aware at that point they were going to come in with a new expert.
But it allowed them to do that. So if you objected, that's your written order, and there's your objection right there for them to look at it, because it is odd. It is odd for a court to reopen it. I don't know what was said. We don't know. There were no trial transcripts for us to look at. So we're behind the ball in that we can't see that. But there's nothing in writing on the objection. You don't object until actually the designation after the order.
Yeah, I guess that's when we first realized that we were prejudiced by that order. We just didn't know they were going to attempt to slip in a new expert on us. And so that when we saw that, that's when we reacted. I don't think that should preclude us from objecting now to what occurred. I think that was a clear abuse of discretion to allow them to bring in a new expert. And then, of course, there's all of these other violations of the rules with regards to naming an expert. No expert report. This guy's completely new. They had named five experts previously. They didn't use any of them, except this new one who apparently had things to say that they agreed with.
Why didn't you take his deposition? You still had time before trial to take his deposition.
Well, that's true, but we would have to go back to the East Coast to do that. We didn't have an expert witness report from him, so we didn't know what he was going to testify to. And frankly, our resources were limited. We're just a one-man firm.
Mm-hmm.
We've put a lot of costs into this case with our experts, and we just didn't feel it was right that they could call in a new expert who, as it turned out, really didn't have an alternative theory of the case. All he came in and testified to was, I believe Dr. Smith. Well, that's fine, but does that really meet the Daubert standards of looking at the record and telling us why he believes Dr. Smith, other than it's just Dr. Smith? And, you know, what struck me as persuasive is when he said that I believe Dr. Smith because no reasonable electrophysiologist would sit around for 8 minutes and allow the patient to incur brain damage. Well, I agree with that. That's why we're in court, is because that's exactly what he did. So, you know, his conclusory opinion is really not an expert opinion. It's just an opinion like you or I might have from looking at the record and not being an electrophysiologist and coming to the conclusion that, well, he's competent, he knew what he was supposed to do, but, you know, so he must have done it.
But in almost every med mal case I've ever presided over, it's always an error by omission, you know, scribing by omission. It's never in there, and it certainly wasn't in here, what you're talking about, the delay in care. So they have nothing else, because there's nothing else in the record.
Well,
that's in almost every medical malpractice case. That
well, I think unless he has an alternative theory as to why Dr. Smith wasn't negligent, his testimony basically should have been disregarded and should have been allowed to come in and testify in the first place. Highly prejudicial to us. And that's why we're asking for a new trial on this matter and go back to the original, what this case, the posture of this case, as of the day it was, the summary judgment was granted by Judge Flanagan. They told the court 100% of the discovery was completed at that point. They had their motion for summary judgment using their expert, Dr. Marotti. Dr. Chapman wasn't even around. They didn't even mention him. And so their motion for summary judgment was granted on Dr. Marotti's testimony. So now they want to come in after the case is remanded and bring in a new expert.
Here's the issue. Okay, so the district court, after the remand, does what it does with the scheduling order. Okay, it extends time, but it didn't just extend time for them. It extended time for everybody. You could have done more stuff. You could have done, you know, you could have produced another expert. You could have produced more discovery. The period of time is neutral as to who does what. It turns out that they were the only ones who did anything because they tried to add this new expert. But you could have done some stuff during that time. So here's my question. If you had also done something in that time, are you actually conceding with your argument that everything everybody did during that extra time would have been proper, including anything that you would have done, because the scheduling order in extension in and of itself was wrong?
Right. And we're saying that maybe some other things could have been done, but not naming a new expert at that point. That was completely abuse of discretion at that point to allow that to happen. And it's hard enough to battle two professional negligence cases at the same time. I mean, we're up against Dr. Smith, and we're up against Mr. Balkovich, all of which require expert testimony, and all of which is very, very difficult for us to counter that. Now, if they were allowed to run in another expert because they don't like how this case is postured after the Supreme Court ruling, that's
what was said during that conference, though? What was said? Do you recall? During that conference, I mean, didn't you flip out on Flanagan and say, what are you doing? We were 20 days away from trial. Maybe you could fill us in because there is no transcript on it, but it doesn't make, I agree, it doesn't make any sense on what's with the year of discovery when you were right up to trial. He grants summary judgment. It's a remand. You should have just set it for trial like the next month. That's it. What was said? Tell us, fill in that hole for us.
To be honest with you, I'm completely candid, I don't remember much about that scheduling conference.
Uh-huh.
When he called us in there and we discussed it, as far as I can recall, at that point we really weren't alarmed because we figured there's a lot of issues with regards to scheduling and so forth. But when all of a sudden we saw a new expert being we did react.
But it's like reopening discovery. Maybe they can tell the court what happened at that conference, because it doesn't make sense why it was reopened. But I think, well, it doesn't make sense, doesn't mean that the district court abused its discretion. That's what I'm looking for. What went down there that we can look at or hear about in argument?
Well, I think I don't know if there's a transcript made of that scheduling conference.
No, it's not.
I just don't remember too much about it, except that we were not really that much alarmed at the scheduling conference at that point.
But that reopened discovery. That scheduling or that conference came along with the February 1st order that reopened your discovery for both sides, which is what Judge Schell said.
There was also an order that said that if they wanted to reopen discovery, they had to file a motion. So there was a conflicting...
Well, but, I mean, here, let me just drill down on this for a second.
On the record, I'm sorry. Go ahead, sorry.
No, good. Well, I mean, on the date that discovery was reopened, okay, it either didn't prejudice you any more than it prejudiced them. There's no prejudice to anybody, or both sides are equally prejudiced because it's reopening discovery as to everybody. What's intrinsically prejudicial about that on the day that it happened? Or is your argument just that it wasn't prejudicial until they added the expert and that's the problem? What's the problem here that you're saying happened? Is it the reopening discovery or is it what they did in the reopening of discovery? And if it's the reopening of discovery, what's intrinsically prejudicial about that to you?
Well, it's very prejudicial. Discovery was closed. They stated that when they argued before Judge Flanagan on the motion for summary judgment. They stated that discovery was closed. 100%. The case is ready for trial. Of course it's prejudicial to us to reopen discovery. We don't want to go into all this other fact discovery or expert discovery. We're 20 days from trial. Of course it's more prejudicial to us than it is to the defendants. They're in trouble. We've got good experts. We're ready to go. 20 days from trial. Court remands. Judge Flanagan gives them a do-over. If you don't like the expert, Mr. Marotti, then go ahead and name another expert who might give you a more favorable opinion. That's where it all comes down. So that's our plea, and I'd like to reserve some of my time if there's no further questions.
Thank you.
Did you have a question that we were both asking?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. You said something. Where in the record did you just say there was something else you had just stated? And I said, where in the record right before he asked his question? But I can't remember now. I started looking at something else. Sorry, I was looking at other issues. Thank you. All right, we'll hear from respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dominique Pallera. I represent the defendants in this case, the respondents, and I'm here with Robert Fole, who is my co-counsel in the case as well. May it please the court and counsel, initially what I would like to point out to this court is like counsel did in his opening brief and in his reply brief, counsel has made improper factual assertions to this court by failing to cite to the record. And I want to just point out two of them quickly for you. Number one, he has claimed that the court modified a prior scheduling order, or at least that was the implication from what he was arguing to this court. In fact, he fails to cite to any prior scheduling order that Judge Flanagan issued. There's nothing in the record in that regard. In fact, the appendix does not include a prior scheduling order. Mr. Kozak continues to conflate or to confuse the prior pretrial order, which in fact is not a scheduling order. There is no evidence that there was a prior scheduling order before the order that he issued on February 1st of 2016.
But discovery was closed before when you filed summary judgment, right? It was closed.
Yes, it was.
So if discovery was closed and then you file summary judgment, it's closed, there's a remand, the only thing for the court to do at that point is to go to trial. What good cause can you point to that allowed Judge Flanagan to reopen discovery for a year and allow you to add experts?
Well, what I would say is that because this issue was not raised by plaintiff's counsel below, I cannot speak to what Judge Flanagan's state of mind was. And Your Honor, because Mr. Kozak never raised that issue, he never raised the issue that there was some lack of authority or that Judge Flanagan did not have discretion to enter that scheduling order. That was not an issue that he raised after he got the scheduling order. It was not an issue that he raised after he got our expert disclosure. It was not raised in his motion to strike. It was not raised in his motion in limine.
Is the second judicial district paperless as well? Are the district courts paperless? So that, for example, in the eighth, as district court judges, something pops up on calendar, we have no file to flip through. we basically just go with whatever the attorneys are saying in court. So it's quite often in the eighth, we never know where we are within the proceedings because we're paperless. So was Judge Flanagan paperless that he didn't know where he was in the proceedings on remand? I guess that's my question.
Well, I believe, based upon my practice in that district, that it's kind of a combination that they have paper files, but there also is electronic filing. So I can't speak specifically as to what Judge Flanagan had in his mind. And the reason I can't speak to that is that counsel never raised that issue below. And so Judge Flanagan never had an opportunity on the record to explain why he issued a scheduling order. I do concede that it may be slightly unusual. However, I will tell you that, you know, you asked, Your Honor, a question of counsel regarding what happened at that scheduling conference. I remember that scheduling conference. There was a discussion generally about what was going to happen, the scheduling of the trial. There was absolutely no objection by counsel for plaintiffs about reopening discovery or anything along those lines. And Judge Flanagan specifically said, well, I'm going to issue a scheduling order. He said that during the course of that scheduling conference. And from my standpoint, being a trial lawyer in that district, that's very commonly what occurs. And I thought nothing more of it.
On remand, that's what occurs from the Supreme Court. That's common?
Well,
after discovery's closed?
Well, I will tell you that I've never personally been in that situation where there's been a remand after a motion for summary judgment. So
they've all been good, right?
So in any event, but when I got the scheduling order, you know, I take those scheduling orders seriously as an officer of the court and as an attorney representing a party. And, Your Honor, I then relied on that scheduling order. Mr. Kozak, I think, concedes that he received the scheduling order. He had every opportunity. Approximately 7 months went by between the time that scheduling order, and it was the first scheduling order in the case, that scheduling order was issued, and when we disclosed experts. We disclosed experts in consistent with that scheduling order. And in fact, I think that we complied with that scheduling order.
So, Ms. Parr, was there a discussion? We don't have the transcript, and that's apparently the appellant's detriment. But you have this remand. It's 2 years later. You have the conference, and you sit down with the judge, and you say, we're ready to go to trial, or we're not. We're ready because discovery's closed. All we have to do is set a new trial date, set it on the earliest possible date. We'll take a backup to many other cases, and we'll be done. Or you say, things have changed over the last 2 years. We need to reopen discovery, and this case should not be set right away. And there are things that will happen, including possibly new experts. I mean, that would be the discussion at the conference, something along those lines, wouldn't it?
There was not that detailed of a discussion, Your Honor. It was more, this case has come back. We need to now get this case back on calendar, and I'm going to issue a new scheduling order.
Right, the scheduling order covers many subjects, one of them being discovery. I can remember countless cases, not on remand from the Supreme Court, but just a continuance of the trial. And so the court would issue a new scheduling order, but the question would always be, what about the discovery portion of the scheduling order? Is it different now because discovery was already completed? And counsel would say, no, we haven't finished it, we want to do this, or we have. Or they would disagree and the court would make a decision. But I mean, it would be a critical part of the discussion in terms of drafting a new scheduling order.
And Your Honor, I agree with that. I agree with what you're saying. However, counsel for plaintiff, so we have a scheduling order from Judge Flanagan.
And the scheduling order had a blank about the expert issue.
But it had to do with rebuttal experts. Okay. It had to do with reports for rebuttal experts. It did not say anything about the fact that expert reports had been waived with regard to the initial expert disclosure, if you look at that scheduling order. Mm-hmm. Now, what I would say, again, is that I understand what the court is saying, and I acknowledge that, yes, that is one way that the discussion could have proceeded. However, when the scheduling order was issued by the court, if there was some objection to that scheduling order by the plaintiff, it was incumbent upon them at that point to raise it with the court so then we could go back and have a further discussion about it. And, in fact, plaintiff's counsel did not do that.
Did you want it reopened? I mean, it was closed. Why did you want it reopened? What was the good cause to reopen it?
Well, from my standpoint, Your Honor, I was new counsel in the case. The prior attorney who had handled this case up to the motion for summary judgment had retired. I assumed that case while the case was pending in front of the Supreme Court. And at that point, up until we received the decision from the Supreme Court, I had not had really any involvement in what the merits of the case were, what needed to be done, what more needed to be done. And in fact, I was happy that discovery was reopened because it allowed me to do additional things in the case to represent my client. So I had no reason to question that scheduling order. I welcomed the scheduling order, and if there had been a complaint about it, it was incumbent upon plaintiff's counsel to raise that as an issue before it was too late. So we relied on that scheduling order. I think we were justified in doing that because we had no notice that there was a problem with that scheduling order prior to that time. I would like to move, if I could, to another issue, which has to do with the issue of expert reports, because Mr. Kozak is making a number of different arguments in that regard as well. Number one, expert reports were waived in this case. Number two, if you look carefully at the documents, at no point did Mr. Kozak object or claim that the expert disclosure that we filed and served on September 2nd was defective in the context of the content of that disclosure. I admit he objected to Dr. Calkins being added as an expert. And by the way, he says there were five experts. Well, some of those were experts with regard to the subsequent legal malpractice case because it was a bifurcated proceeding. But at no point did he at any point say, I object that this expert disclosure is defective because it does not contain an expert report from your experts. In fact, he never claimed that we needed to give him an expert report for Dr. Marotti, and he never provided an expert report for his expert, Dr. Seifert. So in fact, when you say
the expert reports were waived in this case, is there some kind of signed stipulation to that effect? Was that some informal thing?
Joint case conference report, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And so basically, and when you look at the correspondence and you specifically look at the motion to strike, counsel does not argue in that motion to strike that the expert disclosure was defective because it did not include an expert witness report. He claims that it was improper for us to disclose Dr. Calkins, but in fact, there's no evidence that he made any complaint about not having an expert witness report until the motion for summary, or the motion in limine. In the motion in limine, he argues in one line, we never got an expert witness report. It's the first time he raises it, and Your Honors, there's no evidence, and he's produced nothing in the record as to what the court's decision was on that motion in limine, what the order was on that motion in limine. The record is completely silent. So and I would say that that was an improper argument. They've not cited to anything in the record regarding what the court's decision was on that point. Now, what I would like to last talk about briefly in the remaining time I have is this issue about prejudice. Now, I think counsel has conceded here, and I would point you back to the motion to strike in this case. In the motion to strike, counsel argued that the defendants would not be prejudiced if Dr. Calkins was stricken as an expert because his testimony was going to be merely cumulative of what Dr. Marotti was going to say. So there would be no prejudice by striking him. In fact, there's no evidence in this case that Dr. Calkins said anything different than what Dr. Marotti was anticipated to testify to. And so In fact, he's conceded that point in his motion to strike, and he can point to nothing in the record that he was surprised by Dr. Calkins' testimony, that Dr. Calkins' testimony was somehow a different theory from what Dr. Moradi was going to testify to. Again, he cites to nothing in the record to support that argument.
So you're saying because you didn't use Dr. Moriarty, right, and it's the same argument, how can he be prejudiced? If they would have called Moriarty, he would have said the same thing that Calkins said.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying.
And he's shown there's no evidence to the contrary that's before this court. The other thing I would say, Your Honors, is that there's no evidence. He makes some vague arguments. He points to nothing in the record with regard to prejudice. He makes a comment in his motion to strike without any basis. He makes in his reply brief, again, for the first time in his reply, so we are unable to rebut or respond to those allegations about the fact that Dr. Moradi had some different opinion. Again, that's not in the record. In addition, he makes the argument for the first time that there was no time left to depose Dr. Calkins because of the fact that the motion to strike and then the motion in limine were denied. In fact, he had 4 months to depose Dr. Calkins, and in fact, he never intended to depose Dr. Calkins. He could have gone to the court and asked for some dispensation. He could have asked for the court to order that I bring him to Nevada so that he could be deposed. He could have asked for any method of relief. Again, the record is silent that he did any of that. In fact, Dr. Moradi is from Michigan. He never traveled to Michigan to take his deposition. He never intended to go to Michigan to take his deposition. There's no evidence that there would have been any additional cost that would have inured because of this change in expert witness. So number one, he can't show any prejudice because he's conceded that it was cumulative and there's no evidence that his testimony would have been any different. And in fact, there's no evidence that he was actually going to go and depose him in the first place. Lastly, there's no indication that he was surprised at all by any of the testimony that Dr. Calkins gave in the case. And I think it's notable, Your Honors, that if you read Dr. Calkins' trial testimony, at no point does counsel object once to any of the testimony that Dr. Calkins puts forth at all. He doesn't object to the bases. He doesn't object to the foundation. He doesn't object at all and allowed Judge Flanagan an opportunity to rule on those objections.
Thank you so much for your argument.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear appellant in rebuttal or in response.
Well, I think you can see by counsel's concession, this was a great advantage to her. She was coming in on this case while it was up on appeal, and she was delighted that discovery was reopened, because now she has an opportunity for a do-over. She can go in and do additional discovery. She can name an additional expert, and she can proceed to the prejudice of my client as a result of the fact that she was new to the case. She could have moved
to
reopen.
That all may be
true, but if you don't like something that the district court does, you have a duty to object to it. An objection serves two purposes. It's not just to flag things for us, but it's to give the district court a chance to fix something that you don't like. So if you didn't object, how does the district court know that you have a problem with anything that it's doing?
As soon as she named that additional expert, we objected in three different ways. We even filed a mandamus petition.
Right, but you didn't. I mean, we have the handicap here, as you've heard. You know, a couple of my colleagues mentioned that we don't have the transcript of what happened at the first hearing when the district court extended the discovery period. But it seems like you're conceding, or at least you don't remember, that you didn't object then to the idea of the extension. So how can you argue it now that that's a problem?
Well, I guess because at that point, we didn't see any real prejudice until we suddenly see a new expert hearing.
Well, let me ask you and follow up with the prejudice. You know, your counsel in opposition says that there is no prejudice. Dr. Calkins' testimony was exactly like Dr. Moriarty's. I hope I'm saying it right. It was not. I mean, I realize that Moriarty was kind of flopping like a fish at some point. You know, he switched sides. I get that. But let's say the last thing he testified to for the defense, you knew about. And in fact, you said it's cumulative, so you should strike Calkins. What is different in the testimony of Culkin that prejudices you from Moriarty? Because you already knew Moriarty from the first, you know, when discovery closed. Tell me what is different. What did Culkin say that was totally different than Moriarty as far as going just to the verdict here?
Yeah, that's easy.
Okay.
Moriarty was going to testify that the reason Mr. DeChambeau expired was because he waited too long to do the cardiosynthesis.
The procedure that the plaintiff, okay.
That's right. Right in his affidavit, that's what he says. He waited too long.
That's what Culkin said.
But did you object?
Culkin did not say that.
I'm sorry, so Culkin didn't say that.
No, he said that he went ahead and did it timely. It's a direct contradiction. So it's completely different. I understand. And I fully sympathize with
why they did. The argument was that there was no objection made during the course of his testimony. The only objection was to allowing him to be named at all. And was that it? Was that the only objection? So we're back to the procedural point of how did he get added, not to what he said.
Well, I think he did argue that his Dr. Moriarty's testimony was adverse to Dr. Culkin's testimony.
Right, but during Dr. Culkin's testimony at the trial, that there was no objection to the content of his testimony.
Oh, at the trial, we tried to introduce the affidavit of Dr. Moriarty, and it was denied.
That's not the same thing as an objection to the content or the qualifications of the expert. Did you make that objection?
I don't think we did. I think at that point we analyzed his testimony and realized that he was just basically testifying as a personal opinion, but it was directly adverse to Dr. Moriarty. And they never gave a reason why Dr. Moriarty couldn't come out and testify. I was prepared to get on an airplane and go back and for the trial deposition of Dr. Moriarty virtually the day that Judge Flanagan granted their motion for summary judgment. So we were going to...
call him in your case in chief? You were going to call him?
No, we were going to cross-examine him because they were going to take his trial deposition back in Michigan. I was already get on the plane to go back and participate in that. That's when the motion for summary judgment was granted. This is 20 days prior to trial. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened there. It wasn't that we were derelict. We didn't have any intention of doing that. I was on my way to the airport virtually when that motion for summary judgment was granted. So that's all we have.
Thank you so much. Thank you. This case will stand submitted.